You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. This is your show for May 5th, 2012, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everybody.
And we have a couple of special guests with us today. Seth Shostak.
Hi.
Seth, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
It's a pleasure.
And James Randi. James, welcome back.
Bonsoir.
Classy. Classiest one in the room.
Always.
Seth is with SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. We've had you on the show a couple of times before. Again, it's always fun to have you on the show. How have things been going over at SETI?
Well, we only found a Type 3 civilization last week, so it was hardly worth it.
Boring. No, boring.
No, we're busy looking at stars that are known to have planets discovered by NASA's Kepler telescope. So in a way, that's quite exciting.
Is that changing the way you're doing things, the fact that we're discovering actual planets?
Well, clearly, if you point the antennas in the direction of a star that's known to have planets, that's a better bet than pointing it at a random star. But I think that the most important thing that we're learning from Kepler is what fraction of stars have planets. And it looks like that fraction is so high that you can just point them anywhere at any star with a reasonably good chance that you're at least pointing at something that has some encircling worlds.
We may talk about that more in a little while, but let's first get to this day in skepticism.
I want to point out that we have another special guest.
And who is that?
It's a special guest that is composed of 20-some fans of SGU.
Are they making a human caterpillar?
What has 20 heads and 200 toes?
I'll take things Steve will edit out of the podcast for 200.
Just call it a meta guest.
Can we hear some applause from our audience? So. All right.
I didn't even need to raise them.
All right. So there's people upstairs that are having sex in a suite.
And they're saying, thank you very much.
Yeah, I just wanted our podcast listeners to know in case they hear people in the background.
Yep. We did this once before. Way to break the fourth wall. Good job.
That's what I do. That's what I do.
Is there a fourth wall in podcasting? I don't know.
There is now.
Yeah. I enjoy these shows. It's only the second one we've done. But
yeah, you love a crowd. I know, Rebecca.
So
this day in
things happen.
Science, skepticism, and history.
Yeah. Well, today is the anniversary of the first U.S. spaceflight. Steve, did you know that?
I did. Sam Shepard, right?
Sam Shepard. Is he an actor?
Close. yes, Alan Shepard.
Alan Shepard.
That's his brother.
You might have heard of him. Made a 15-minute
barely counted.
Suborbital.
I'd
like to see you do it.
4 foot one.
Do you know how high up he went?
115 miles.
Steve just knew that. He's got in front of it.
He was the first American, you said?
Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And what was he in terms of humanity? Was he second or third or fourth? I mean, we were beat by the
Soviets.
By the
Yeah, Yuri Gagarin. Yeah.
Right, Yuri, but then after him, was there anybody
assortment of zoological specimens that
Laika,
went up?
For example.
Monkeys and dogs.
We talked
about that recently.
Laika, but he was the second person then.
I'm not sure that Alan Shepard was the second person. The Russians may have had somebody else.
More than one? Okay.
They didn't like a couple of die and they didn't talk about it.
Well, that makes a good story.
Yeah.
It does make a good story. I agree.
Did they erase him from pictures and stuff? I remember seeing pictures and it was like, pre-Photoshop, that doesn't look very good.
Yeah, the trading cards were taken back.
So, okay. So
what did they call it before Photoshop?
What did they send him? I can't even picture what the capsule looked like. For some reason, I don't.
But that was the Mercury program.
Yeah, it was the Freedom 7. Riding on the Mercury.
So it was a single man capsule.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were. I was just in D.C. at the Smithsonian, and they have all those capsules on display, and it's really remarkable to see how tightly they stuff them in there, and every square inch is utilized for
that's
some
budget
purpose.
Problems.
Yeah. No, it is. It's really cool. It's really amazing, and it's particularly amazing that the things on display at the Smithsonian are the actual. These things went into space. They're right there on the other side of that bit of plastic keeping you from manhandling it.
Isn't that the one where the guy had a pee in his spacesuit? That's mm-hmm. Guy was one of the astronauts that did the Mercury
and they
missions.
Gave him permission to pee.
Right. Have you read Mary Roach's Packing for Mars? I feel like you would really like it, Jay, because it's mostly about astronauts pooping in space. I'd say like 90% of it is about poop.
It's like the evolution of how pooping has changed in space?
Yeah, about, yeah, like the, and the serious, scientists who had spent a lot of time figuring out the easiest way to poop into a bag, you know. They tried diapers and the astronauts absolutely hated it. The astronauts would not eat specifically because pooping was such a major issue.
I gotta know, how do they do it now?
Is this one of our classier shows?
This is a step up.
Rebecca, was it packing for Mars or crapping for Mars? What was the title?
You took it down another notch. Good job.
I had to go there. Come on.
It was impacting for Mars.
It was impacting for Mars.
Okay.
You'll have to read the book to find out what they're doing.
Good answer.
Now.
Okay.
It has a shitty ending.
Mary Roach owes me a dollar.
May 5th, though, is another momentous day in science and skepticism. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. May 5th, 7 years ago, episode 1 of the SGU.
That's right. Hello.
A classic in its own right. In its own right.
Like, seriously, if you guys haven't heard it, you should.
It's so
you got to go back.
It's like Perry yelling, "What's happening?"
And I can't hear you. Steve saying, "Perry, turn your mic down."
Your mic down.
Before we got the whole editing thing down to a science. Yeah, it was rough, but it was nostalgic. If nothing else,
it doesn't feel like 7 years. It really did go by fast. I mean, are we going to be doing this 7 years from now?
No, guys, a grown man came up to me today and said, "I'm a big fan. I've been listening to you since I was 14.
Whoa.
What?
Oh.
Oh,
boy.
Terrifying.
14 what? Bob, you want to talk about rogue planets?
I guess.
Yeah, you know how it is. We're always pushing on Bob. Could you please talk about astronomy?
And make it long.
But I read a recent article about billions of stars in the Milky Way having captured rogue planets. They did Harvard and Smithsonian Institution scientists. They did some sort of simulation. They ran a simulation of young star clusters, and they put a lot of rogue planets in there, and they had a lot of stars. And they found that 3-6% of the stars captured these rogue planets. And so they kind of extrapolated that, there could be billions and billions of stars that have rogue planets, planets that didn't evolve with the solar system, but were just kind of captured. And so I did a little bit of research on rogue planets, and they're kind of interesting. They can occur naturally. Solar systems that have planets, and as Seth was saying earlier, Kepler's seeing so many planets out there. You could have weird gravitational interactions that just kind of like catapult out a planet, and it becomes a rogue planet. And apparently rogue planets can be created also just kind of like on their own, which I thought was kind of weird. I never read that before.
Not as part of a
solar system, but just kind of like coalescing out of whatever in space and becoming a planet that becomes a rogue planet from day one, which I had never heard
about. Is that just like a failed star? Is that what they're talking about?
No, well, really failed because it's planetary. Really lame star. I mean,
that's a real failure.
Actually, I think they actually call it a sub-brown dwarf. But it's planetary in scale, so it's like, well, okay.
So is it a gas giant? Like,
no, it's
like a Jupiter.
Yeah. I think even smaller than that. But I guess it could be Jupiter size. But my impression was that it was smaller than Jupiter size. But they still called it sub brown dwarfs because it never formed within a solar system. But
is it the same process as forming a solar system? Just that the center never was big enough to get to develop into a star. So you just have a bunch of planets with no star. Is that what they're talking about?
No, the article I read kind of was leaning towards it just kind of formed and became a rogue planet and was coursing through
the isolation.
In isolation. Is that was that?
Well, I haven't heard that, but what I have heard and what is apparently true, based strictly on theory, mind you, no observations here, is that, for example, our solar system has eight planets now, but if you ask the theoreticians how many planets it originally had when it was born 4.5 billion years ago, it was more like 30 or 40. Mm-hmm. And because these planets are, you know, in sort of arbitrary trajectories at the beginning till they settle in, they have sort of fender benders. They don't actually hit, but they get close. So when that happens, one gets speeded up, the other gets slowed down. Most of them have gotten kicked out. So these are orphan planets, and that's a slightly different thing. But what Bob is saying here is that, so the majority of planets don't have a parent. right? They're I don't know if that's apparent to you. They're just wandering around, and what Bob's saying is some of them get captured again in a stellar cluster where you have a lot of suns that might happen.
But in a system like that, why would all the planets be going the same way?
Because the cloud that formed the star and the planets had a little bit of spin. It's very hard to have any
I understand that, but I'm talking about planets that are captured from someplace else or wander into the system.
Well, that's actually a good point, because actually that's one of the hallmarks of a captured rogue planet is one would be an eccentric orbit. Another one would be a planet that's like a thousands of times farther away from the sun than, say, the Earth is. So it's really far away. Yeah. And the other one is that it could have a motion that's the opposite of the planets.
Well, retrograde orbit. I mean, we don't say anything like that, but I mean,
well, that's just
the problem
really
is
these.
That it's much harder. The problem with capturing a planet, I don't know how many of you ever tried to capture a planet. The problem, all right, two.
Yes.
The problem.
Is it like catching a dream?
I failed.
Or a rainbow?
Yeah, it's a dream catcher. But the problem is that you've got to slow it down. You got to slow it down. And it's much more effective to slow it down by other planets that are moving in the same direction as the thing you're trying to capture. Mm.
Plus, even to be captured, you've got to just happen to be moving in the same direction at a similar velocity. Very, very rare, right? So, but still, the thing that really blew me away is that they're calculating that there could be hundreds of thousands more rogue planets than stars in the galaxy. Billions and billions of these rogue planets that they're talking about. That's huge.
If a star on average is kicking out 20 or 30 planets.
Right.
Before you're left with the stable orbits that remain, right? That's essentially what's happening, is that these planets that are in the stable orbits are the ones that survive for billions of years.
Right.
If you're in a slightly unstable orbit, you're going to be kicked out eventually.
Yeah, or you're going to get swallowed. I mean, a lot of planets get swallowed up.
Yeah, but that's how planets are created. They get just accrete after all these collisions, and they build up. But, some planets are getting kicked out just because they happen to be –
This is all computer modeling, right?
It is. It isn't
to say that it's more than 6,000 years, and we know that that's the limit.
That's the magic number.
And that's the other thing, is that they really – a lot of this is speculation and simulation, and they haven't really found a lot of these – or any of these rogue planets. They can't really say that's definitely a rogue. Yeah.
Think how hard it is to find one, though.
Right.
So we haven't found a rogue exoplanet yet.
They have some good candidates, but they nothing definitive yet. It's just
okay. All right, so let me get this straight. These planets start off in a solar system. There's too many planets, so they get kicked out. So they're like these orphans, so they lose their parents, and they're traveling on their own in the dark, and they become rogues. It's roguish planet.
They're like, depends on their behavior.
It's like the Wild West.
I think you may be overly personifying these large masses.
No, but it all kind of does follow a story. There is a story here. But this is pretty cool, because first of all, I never even thought of a solar system having 20 or 30 planets in it. That's so cool. I never even imagined that. Just kind of picture everything kind of like ours. But from what Seth was saying, it seems like solar systems are comfortable with a certain size, and right, like you can't really have them be that big because it just doesn't work. So that's probably why the average solar system has a certain number of planets. That's in the lower numbers and in the higher numbers.
I have a question for you, Seth. The idea was floating around about the mathematical relationship between the distances of the planets from
Bode's law.
Bode's law. So what's the modern thinking on that? Was that just an anomaly, mathematical curiosity, or is there something to it?
It was thought that there's a very simple relationship that gives you, in fact, the orbits of the planets. Okay.
Right.
And it was thought, is this just numerology? In the old days, of course, they thought there was some sort of divine reason for this.
Yeah.
And then it was considered only numerology. But I think that today, there's a more, if you will, subtle, nuanced view of this, that in fact, you just can't have an arbitrary planetary system and have it survive for very long periods of time, because the planets are tugging on one another. And it isn't very much of a tug, but when you're talking billions of years, they mount up. So
it is chaotic.
Eventually, but maybe not in the lifetime of the sun, for example. So the question is, does Bode's law actually have some real physical basis? And I wouldn't bet against it at this point.
So it was like there may be some gravitational reason why the planets sort of settle into these orbits, but we don't know what that is yet.
It's like cannonballs. There are better ways to stack them than others.
Yeah. Okay.
How about this? I was reading more about rogue planets, and they were speculating about the possibility of these rogue planets having life and some sort of livable conditions based on heat generated by the planet, based on the radioactive decay can cause heat.
But there'd be no light and day.
No, but there would be there are potentially certain atmospheric conditions that could permit some hydrogen based life, something that they were speculating just about life on a planet with no star, which I thought was like, wow, what an awesome idea.
What Bob's saying, it could be, because look, when you make a planet, it's very hot. Right? Most of you don't remember what the Earth was like 4.5 billion years ago. But if you read about it, yeah, Randy does. And it was hot. It was hot because all this stuff is slamming into the nascent Earth, the young Earth. And of course, you know, all that energy gets converted into heat. So they're very hot. And, you know, the Earth is covered with this crust, which is a pretty good insulator. So it's a nice thermos bottle. So the center of the Earth, I mean, you know, you go, dig a hole here, 20 miles deep. You can do this weekend if you do, and you'll find that at the bottom it's very, very warm. And a lot of that heat, some of it's due to radioactivity, but a lot of that heat is just left over from the birth of the Earth.
Right.
So there's life even on Earth that doesn't depend on sunlight.
Well, chemosynthetic life, like bacteria.
At the bottom of the ocean, at these you know, these hydrothermal vents,
there's
life.
Awesome.
So if it could be on the Earth, you could have life like that. I don't think you'd have Klingons living on a rogue planet, but you could have some
sort of life. Maybe you could have a furry lobster. Remember Simply the Furry Lobster?
Europa.
Good eating.
Morlocks.
Yeah,
all right, we're going to move on to some monkey news.
Monkey news.
Ooh, ooh, ah, ah.
It's only sort of monkey news. It's also brain-machine interface news.
Again,
yeah. But this is a little different. It's slightly different.
Did they make any improvements yet?
This is what they did. Some researchers took some nice, innocent monkeys, and they paralyzed them.
No!
But there was only temporary.
Why would they paralyze the mean monkeys?
It was only temporary. They injected something into their spinal cord so they couldn't move their limbs.
And then they tickled them.
It's temporary.
Are you crying, Rebecca?
Oh, my gosh. I'm just thinking of the poor little paralyzed monkeys.
No, but they're – so listen.
Stop thinking about them.
About the news item from the other week where they were teaching them to read.
Rebecca, it's even worse. They let birds attack them.
No.
They let birds – that's right. Peck on the paralyzed monkeys. so put in a computer chip, a brain-machine interface, and they connect the electrodes directly to the muscles in the monkey's hand. So what they first did, though, was that they would like have the monkey pick something up and go through some task they taught it to do.
And then slap itself.
Why are you hitting yourself?
Before they did the brain-machine interface, they essentially taught a computer what muscles the monkey was using to do a task. So that the computer knew the pattern of muscle contractions. Then they paralyzed the monkey, and then they connected a computer chip with the algorithm in there directly to the muscles. They completely bypassed the spinal cord. And then the monkey was able to control the muscles directly so basically the chip would interpret the brain signals, knew what they meant because it was already, or had already learned what the brain signals correlate to what the muscle movements. And so the monkeys were able to do almost as well control the hand completely bypassing the spinal cord, just direct brain to muscle connection.
That's huge.
It's nice. See, you thought it was the same old thing.
Well, that's what you led me to believe.
Well, yeah, I have to give you something exciting.
Okay, thank you.
So, I mean, obviously the application here is you have a paralyzed person, and you could have them control their muscles directly, even if their spinal cord is severed or whatever. So this research has been ongoing, and this is one more step. We always do the cool stuff with monkeys because you could actually like implant stuff in their brains. With people, we're trying to avoid doing that, so they get the brain caps, which don't work as well as the implanting stuff in their brains.
Yeah, weird. I feel bad because it's monkeys, but if they do it on people, it doesn't bother me. Is that weird?
Yeah, you're right.
No, because people at least can say, yeah, do it
to
me.
They can consent.
Yeah. It's the monkeys, the poor guys.
But the thing is, it was just temporary. They didn't permanently paralyze
them. No. How transferable, though, are those algorithms? Do they have to, like, read you first before you're paralyzed?
Yes.
Well, then
it's unique to each person?
That kind of stinks.
Well,
it's not going to work.
No, it's not true, Jay, because you could train it.
No, because if you're paralyzed, you're going to help a paralyzed person.
Because they tell you, imagine yourself doing what you wanted to do.
Okay.
Your brain will still activate in the same way. It's just like if you imagine yourself doing something and you actually do it, the pattern of brain activation is actually quite similar.
So what if you think
like lucid
you're
dreaming,
flying,
Jay? It's similar.
Well, no, like thing, batting. You know, like you can improve, like if you're a baseball player, if you visualize it, it helps your muscle memory. It's kind of like the secret only yeah. real.
But it works. Yeah.
Well, I mean, even aside from the prosthetic use,
yeah.
Talking to some guy who works in brain-machine interfaces and asking him how long is it going to be before all of us can surf the web by just thinking about it instead of, you know.
What'd he say? What'd he say?
He said 10 years.
Oh.
Wow.
Well, that's what he said.
So that means...
Bob, you may still be alive.
That means 30 years.
10 years. Still be alive. That's kind of that magical number of... It's yeah, 10
years
away. 10
years away.
Means exactly. We have no idea.
Long enough for you to forget that I said 10 years.
Right.
Exactly. Right.
It's either 10 years or one funding cycle, whatever that is.
Or one, like, however long the researcher has to live.
I mean, I actually think 5 years is the most common.
5 years is common.
5 years is common.
It depends on what your funding cycle is. But the 5 years is a common answer. 10 years, to me, means we're not really sure.
Shit.
And but I mean, that's not an unreasonable estimate, actually.
But it's going to happen, right? It's going to happen.
Yes, don't worry, Bob. It will happen. Calm down.
Know it.
Have a cookie.
It's
don't worry.
Happen.
You're going to get your robotic monkey arm, all right? Just
calm
down.
It could easily be 20 years, though.
Does everybody know who Dean Kamen is?
Yes.
Yeah.
The guy that made the Segway.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Quite some time ago, 2.5, maybe 3 years ago, I had a conversation with him. He was talking about this artificial arm that he had built for this amputee who had a stump. This is an astonishing thing. And he was able to slip this arm onto the fella, and with sensors, no connections, no injections or poking wires inside the body at all, but just by conductive patches on the fella's arm, he was able to move the arm and pick up a glass. The first glass wasn't a great success. It went like fall right up in the air. But eventually got to control this thing. In other words, the connections to the nerves in the guy's system were made just from patches stuck on the skin on the inside.
Yeah, that technology's 15 years old. I mean,
remember. Yeah.
But
I've seen it connected to
I've seen a guy walk
to the
with
chest
that,
muscle though. Like,
really?
Bizarre.
With surface electrodes attached to the leg muscles, and he can activate them in sequence in order to walk. But you know, it takes a lot of training, and only the people who like really do the best could actually walk with any kind of efficiency. And then even then, it's really energy intensive and very awkward. Yeah. You can only get so much precision with the surface electrodes. That's what I was saying. With people, they tend not to do the implantable stuff. With the monkeys, we can implant stuff, in it, and we can get much more precision.
I like how Steve's showing, like, sawing. You know?
But it's also just tough long-term. It's not a good long-term solution to have anything foreign sticking inside your body, because then it's just a pathway for germs. So that's problematic. It's okay if you're doing it on a short-term experiment, but not as a long-term solution. That's why you have to go with surface electrodes or surface EEG readers, but they just don't have the precision that the implantable stuff does.
But they
does.
Must have some sort of other sort of thing, interface. I'm looking for the term. Interface with the nerves and the machine on the outside that are not just patches. I have a feeling that there should be some other interface.
Well, weren't they doing muscle? They're reading like muscle tensing too, as a way to.
Well, I've seen attachments like to the chest muscle, and he would flex the muscle, and by flexing your chest muscle, it would say, you know, contract the fingers. And it looks so weird though, because he's contracting his chest, and his hand is moving, and it's.
It was just a way of activating.
Those muscles. It became a reflex for him. That became how he did it, and he didn't even think about it anymore.
Right, because your brain plasticity, it'll learn how to do whatever. Okay. Seth, this next item, I don't know if you've actually seen this item, but it's in your specialty. This is an article about using robots to find E.T. Did you come across this recently?
This may be a cost-cutting move at my institute. I don't know.
Your job is hanging by a thread, in other words.
Nothing new.
So this is based upon arguments put forward by John D. Matthews. Do you know who that is?
John Matthews, no.
Okay, professor of electrical engineering. He wrote an article in the current issue of Journal of the British Interplanetary Society. And he's essentially arguing, actually similar to an argument you made during your talk today at Nexus, that probably the best way to find ET, he argued, is to build exobots, self-replicating robots that we could just send out into the galaxy and that would propagate through the galaxy.
Von Neumann did that a half a century ago.
I know, it's not exactly a new idea.
Whatever.
But that
okay,
was a long time ago.
So, Steve, are they going to sound like the robot that shot at Chewbacca in the second Star Wars movie?
That would be cool.
That little guy on the Death Star?
The black one, the Hoth. That found him on Hoth. Ming, 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 mat, ming, ming, ming. Remember that thing?
Yeah, of course.
Thank you, whoever did that.
What?
You don't watch Star Wars, do you?
I've seen Star Wars.
The original ones?
Yeah.
Okay.
I know the noise that the R2-D2 makes.
Yeah.
I know that. I don't know whatever that other thing was.
What was that?
That was my Chewbacca impression.
Oh, my God.
I always wondered about Chewbacca. That, you know, would you really want another primate as your co-pilot? Didn't seem right.
I saw the original Patterson picture of the Bigfoot. And they put Chewbacca's bandolier
awesome.
On.
Oh, that's yeah, awesome. That's right.
They did. But I'm not quite sure. Sending them out into the galaxy, I'm not quite sure what that means unless you have particular targets in mind, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you could send it to Mars. You could even send it to the moon. I mean, you remember 2001, there's this big monolith on the moon. Not very informative, but, you know, clearly artificial. And we haven't looked at the moon for monoliths. So you could, you know, just send a whole bunch of robots, not self-replicating ones. I don't think you ever want self-replicating robots. That's a dangerous thing.
I think that was part of the – how do you pronounce his name? Is it von Neumann?
Von Neumann.
Von Neumann architecture was that they were self-replicating and that they would go out, they would mine resources on the planet, build duplicates of themselves, send them out. But the problem is that's actually an argument for why there are no ETs, because people say, well, where are these machines that other civilizations
set up? If they existed, they would be here already.
You
would see them chewing up the universe.
It's funny how that's an argument against ET.
But, you know, on the other hand, you could think of – we have von Neumann machines on Earth. They're called insects.
Yeah.
Right? And they reproduce like crazy and they eat stuff, and yet they don't eat the whole world because, in their case, they're competitors, right?
It's a balance.
So we just need to send out some bigger robots.
Well, the thing is everybody doing that? I mean, it kind of applies. What Bob is saying here is actually a good point. The fact that we don't see the universe being eaten up by von Neumann machines must mean one of two things.
It's kind of disappointing.
Either, well, you can look at it that way.
Fair way of looking at it, Bob. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, it may be that there's a galactic injunction against building these things, and if you build some, you know, the hand of the aliens comes down and
Gort or something.
Yeah, something like that. Either that or it's impossible to build them. There's got to be some reason for this, actually.
Yeah, I mean,
it's impossible.
When you think about it, it seems almost inevitable that the universe would be taken over by super powerful, advanced, mechanical, you know, artificial
maybe it is.
Life.
We're just not seeing it yet.
It's on its way, approaching us at the speed of light.
Yeah, there's a big wave of von Neumann bugs.
It just takes one civilization to create Cylons, and we're
that's
effed.
Right. That's right. Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So isn't that inevitable?
That is so creepy.
Yeah.
Why isn't the universe taken over by Cylons?
Well, you should write a paper
I'm asking,
on that.
Yeah, listen, if I knew, you know, I'd be in Stockholm now collecting my prize. That's all I can say.
You'll invite me, though, when you do?
Wow, now I'm really thinking about this.
All right, next topic.
Wait, I'm not.
No, come on. This is cool. Let's keep going.
This is what
you can always cut
up
it.
At night. Why isn't the universe taken over by science?
This is just a modification of what's called the Fermi paradox.
Yeah.
And a lot of listeners will know about the Fermi paradox. Right. That if the universe has spawned all these civilizations, some of them might be interested in colonization. So why don't we see artifacts of colonization everywhere? Why aren't the aliens everywhere? And that's what Enrico Fermi said at a bad lunch in 1950.
Yeah.
So this is just a variation of that by saying, look, forget about little soft, squishy aliens trying to conquer the galaxy.
Right, right.
That the machines will do it, and they can do it as opposed to biology, which would have a very hard time. And so that's all that Bob is saying, that they should be everywhere. We don't see evidence of them. And it could be that, as you suggest, Bob, that the real problem is that we're just not very good at seeing the evidence.
How about this? Are we just saved by the fact that the universe is really fracking big?
And expanding.
And everything is really far away. And then even if a million years ago, you know, a civilization spawned some of these von Neumann machines, that would they have had enough time by now to get everywhere? Or is it just that space is just too big?
Well, a million years is not enough, but a billion years is. They could be everywhere in the galaxy in a billion years without having to
do
anything very, very difficult. So, or at least, you know, a couple. I mean, the galaxy's been around for, 12 billion years.
Yeah.
That's plenty of time.
Isn't there a basic assumption here that we're making, because we're terrestrials and we would want to go out there and look, that all of these other critters would want to go out there and look too?
Well, maybe most of them are just not interested in that.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, if you walked around the streets of Spain in 1491 and say, hey, would you like to get in this wooden ship, you know, die of scurvy and cross the Atlantic looking for stuff? And 9 out of 10, 99 out of 100, 999 out of 1,000 say, no thanks, I'm happy selling shoes on the streets of Barcelona. But the fact that a few people were willing to do it was all that was necessary. So it's the same argument. Most of them are not interested in colonization. That could be. But it doesn't take many to change the picture.
Guys, what if those machines...
synthetic life. Digital life, they wouldn't care. Just put it on pause for a few millennia.
Yeah, just play a lot of free sale.
Right.
What,
They wouldn't care.
What if those machines that they sent out were bacteria?
Well, yeah, that's what I was that's what I was thinking. I find it odd that we would think of it in terms of, well, yeah, of course they would do machines. But even in our current science news, a lot of what we're talking about is how to create organic life and how to genetically modify organic life. So why wouldn't a highly advanced alien species come up with an organic sort
of thing? It's semantic. I think once you reach a certain level of technological sophistication, what we call machinery or even biology is going to be a joke.
Yeah, but Steve asked a very serious question, and it's a really provocative question, and I'm saying it could be bacteria. You know, what if the machines existed a billion years ago, and this is we're an iteration of an alien species, advanced, super advanced technology.
This idea has been floated a lot, so to speak, and that I mean, it's called panspermia. Yeah. It's never panagia, but it's some sort of sex bias there. But in any case, panspermia, and it works if you want to seed the solar system from Mars, for example. Could we be Martians? That works. You can put a microbe into a rock on Mars, kick it off a rock, have it land on the Earth 4 billion years ago, and we're the descendants of that. That's conceivable. Yeah. But if you talk about putting a microbe, even the toughest microbes that we know about, put them in a rock, kick them off, and send them to, you know, a star 20 light years away, they're dead by the time they get there. It seems they're all dead.
Even like the ones like the Radio Durans, who's like extremophiles that could survive.
I'm told by the astrobiologists, even the toughest microbes can't take it because there's the desiccation, no liquid water. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is there's a very harsh radiation environment in interstellar space.
That's true.
And so it just breaks your apart, and even radio durons can't fix it without water. So.
They're amazing, though. You blow apart most of their DNA, and they're like, oh, that's okay. I could deal with this. And they just kind of like bring it back together, and they're cool with it.
So
but even they can't
take
that.
Should we assume that something that we consider synthetic, not bacterial, but synthetic, it would survive in space easier than what we think that we know to be bacteria? Like, so if we made nanomachines – mm-hmm. Whatever, we don't know what they'd be made out of today. Like we always, you know, we think
just create a little mini magnetosphere around your ship and deflect the cosmic rays and whatever. And then,
I think it takes a big magnetic field. You need
hey, we're talking aliens; they could do a lot.
Aliens can probably do it. But maybe what you do is you just send golf balls into space. You put the machines in there if they're really good, you know.
See, I think
as Richard Feynman said, there's a lot of room at the bottom.
Yes.
What he's saying is that you can make lots and lots of things that are small because there's plenty of room between the size of you and the size of an atom. A lot more than between the size of you and the size, say, of the Earth. Right? A lot more room. So, you know, we're already building machines out of individual atoms and molecules and things like that. I mean, they're very simple things.
All right.
You know, 100 years from now, you can build
nanomachines.
I mean, but I'm not talking biology. I'm talking about stuff that, you know, looks like miniature cars or whatever.
No, absolutely.
Right? So if you can do that, and if they're clever enough that they can make more of themselves from whatever they find, which biology might not be able to do. I mean, biology is contingent upon, you know, having the right kind of stuff.
Very limited, environmental. Wow.
So to answer my question, from what you're saying, it sounds like it's kind of a yes.
What was your question?
We could build something.
We could answer yes anyhow.
That's a lot hardier than bacteria. And that could survive.
Bacteria are awesome, but
When I see these extremophiles living in boiling sulfuric acid, huge pressures and temperatures and such.
No.
So far beyond what we think of NTP, normal temperature and pressure. I'm astonished. There must be other extremes of that too, that we just can't even imagine. I can almost imagine boiling sulfuric acid as being a nice, warm, comfy place to be.
Yeah, right.
And that pressure. Oh, the pressure's so good today. I'm afraid that there might be degrees well beyond that that I just can't comprehend.
Well, take a look at the moon. We haven't found any life there. That's a situation
we haven't found.
Yeah, well, probably isn't it.
A little deeper. Just a little deeper.
Yeah, a little dinosaur DNA.
What about Europa?
I'll buy you lunch if there's life on the moon.
What about Europa?
Let's not forget about space dinosaurs.
Can't forget about them.
All the space dinosaurs, yeah. Always, mm-hmm. Of course.
Well, Rebecca, tell us if scientists have found God in the brain.
Nope.
Next.
Okay, now we can do questions. Okay.
Next question.
I could have told you that.
Yeah.
A little more detail, please.
Fine. It's late, Steve.
All right. Hell no.
We've talked about this topic before on the show, the idea of a God spot in the brain.
G-spot.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. Did he steal your joke, too?
No, I would never make that joke.
Okay.
Just joking. He can have it. the idea is that there's one particular spot in your brain that is responsible for belief in God.
It's called the cortex.
It's called the entire brain. Yeah.
Now, this is an evolved spot, is it?
That's the idea.
No, it's created.
You got me. Okay,
that was good.
By evolution.
Why else would it
depends
be
how big your God spot is.
Right.
There was recently a study that apparently found that there was no God spot in the brain, and that spirituality is linked to the right parietal lobe. And so this is an interesting study. There have been other studies in the past, like I mentioned.
What's the right? Where's the right parietal lobe?
It's this side.
On the
side.
Left side of the.
It's like right above your
above
ear.
Above your ear.
Yeah.
God Steve, spot. How does this relate? I've heard about people that have seizures, certain seizures in certain parts of the brain.
Well, that
gives them this godlike experience. It's like, oh my God, I'm in the presence of God because. I'm not lying.
It's called an orgasm.
Bob, that's like,
no. Oh God.
Bob, that's like. Nah. Bob, that's like, Bob, you're going to die and you're going to see God and you go, God damn.
Some people have seizures. It gives them their body shakes, but other people have a seizure in a part of the brain that gives them this like godlike epiphany.
Have a religious experience. Yeah, we
right
know about
because it's the location and that the seizure takes place.
Yes, this is Steve's profession, but I just want to mention before Steve launches into a full explanation that, like a lot of studies on the brain, this study in particular involves people who have had damage to one specific part of their brain that these researchers were checking to see if that's where the God spot is. So people with brain damage are very useful to brain scientists because it allows you to isolate certain parts of the brain and figure out, you know,
where's the damage.
Right, so what's the answer here?
Well, what Bob is referring to, so what those people experience is a profound connection to the universe. And that gets culturally interpreted as whatever your religious belief is. So if you know you're a Hindu, you have a profound Hindu experience, right? If you're a Christian, you have a mm-hmm. profound Christian experience.
Yeah.
But the core experience is feeling that you're connected to the universe.
What if you're an atheist?
You still feel that, but you just feel a profound connection to the universe rather than you don't personify that as a deity.
Can't call it a God spot.
Somebody in the audience said you're. Thank you. It was DJ.
Yeah. But here's the thing. The reason why you experience that is because that's the part of your brain that makes you feel separate from the universe. So when you turn off that part of the brain, that separation is what goes away. But the separation is what's actively neurologically happening.
Are you saying spatially or emotionally?
So your whole reality is constructed by your brain. Everything that you know, your whole concept of yourself and the universe and that you're in your body and your body is separate from the universe, but in the universe, these are all constructs in the brain. One thing your brain constructs is that at some point you end and the rest of the universe begins. Now you take that away and what are you going to feel? That you are one with the universe.
Like that's a Republican.
That's a very profound experience.
Yeah, but when you say that, I just think like you just feel like you're one big blob.
Sometimes.
Like you're the chair, you're the wall.
You might feel like boundaries. You physically become huge.
Like are you having a sensation from something far away?
No, it's not anything as concrete as that, but it's just So people will interpret this sensation, again, whatever their religious belief is, their cultural belief, and so they may experience that as being in the presence of God, but it really is just a breakdown in their mental construct of reality.
I hate when that happens.
Yeah, okay.
People pay a lot of money for drugs to make that happen.
Well, there you go.
I'm on some of them right now. Let me tell you, it's beautiful. I love you all. Well,
Rebecca, can you feel my ass?
Right now? It's like I'm there.
Is that a question or a request?
So So this study in particular looked at people who had brain damage to the right parietal lobe. It specifically looked at 20 people, which isn't a lot, but from what I understand in studies like this, they tend to be fairly small.
It's hard to find a lot of people with specific brain damage.
Yeah. But also, and this is one of the flaws, I think, in this study, is that there's no control. So everybody in this study has the damage. And what they claim to have found is that they surveyed the participants, asking them about spirituality, general spirituality topics, and how close they felt to a higher power. And what the researchers claim to have found is that people with more damage to the right parietal lobe claim to have more connection to a higher power. So now I'm going to read you a quote from one of the researchers, though, that really it made my skeptic alarm go off, that it made me think that maybe the conclusions the researchers draw might not necessarily be valid based on the evidence. So you can decide for yourself. Neuropsychology researchers consistently have shown that impairment on the right side of the brain decreases one's focus on the self. Since our research shows that people with this impairment are more spiritual, this suggests spiritual experiences are associated with a decreased focus on the self. This is consistent with many religious texts that suggest people should concentrate on the well-being of others rather than on themselves. Mm. Is it just me? Does that sound sketchy?
It's a little sketchy, but also it's, you know, even if that's one factor, there's probably a dozen other factors that also contribute to religiosity that
right.
have nothing to do with that. It's too complicated a phenomenon to say it's due to a decreased focus on the self.
And I know a lot of atheists who do focus on the well-being of others. Is that some artificial, you know, are they outliers? I don't.
Then it depends on how do you define spirituality. Maybe there are humanists who
right.
tend to be spiritual in a non-religious sense. It's way too complicated to boil down to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's messy.
Yeah, as Ben Goldacre says, I think you'll find it's a bit more complicated than
yeah.
that.
And, you know, you got to put this into the context of other research that showed that, you know, there definitely are parts of the brain that correlate with religious experiences or profound experiences or spiritual. Again, it's always hard to interpret that because it's always being filtered through the specific cultural manifestation of underlying neurological processes that are all interacting with each other in very complicated ways. And that's like the earlier article that showed that there is a God spot, like an opposite conclusion, but basically the same data. And they had a map of the brain showing where the God spot is, and it was like 90% of the cortex. It's like the frontal lobes, the temporal lobes, it's everything, except for the parts of the brain that are
spot.
Like your motor cortex and your visual cortex. Okay,
yeah.
Every thinking part of your brain is involved in some way to your religious experience. Yeah, because it's such a very complicated
so it's,
phenomenon.
Would you say that it's just all over the place? It all depends on who you are, number one, or...
Well, it's not a localizable specific phenomenon neurologically.
It's a brain
it's not
phenomenon.
A spot.
Yeah,
that's for
there's
sure.
no spot. I mean, the term spot is such a misnomer. You know, it's like saying what's the part of your brain that's involved in love. Yeah, well, there is no one part of your
I relate
brain.
It
that's
to
a
the,
complicated phenomenon that's going to involve lots of your brain.
It reminds me of the search for the gene for blah,
yeah.
blah, blah. There, you know, and in popular media, it's like, oh, there's a gene for this, but it's
yeah, like
never
the gay
that's,
gene.
The
there's
gay
not going to be a
yeah.
gay gene.
Right.
Yeah, right. There's not going to be a God spot. It's just, yeah. Yeah, it doesn't fit.
What kind of damage are we talking about here? Physical damage to that area of the brain or disconnect?
I think it's usually strokes, I
mostly,
think, or
statistically, yeah.
or collisions to the head, because yeah, it's right there, so it's hittable.
Yeah. Well, Seth, while we got you here, get us up to date on how SETI is doing. I know you guys had some funding problems earlier. Is that sort of settled down a little bit?
Well, it has a bit, Stephen. About a year ago, our partner with the Allen Telescope Array, which is the instrument we use for our studies up in Northern California, the University of California, Berkeley, lost most of their funding, and consequently they had to withdraw from the project. So suddenly we had to find the money not only to do the science but also to maintain and run the array. And we have found another partner, SRI, they're working with the Air Force, so they use the array part of the time for
yeah.
mapping space junk and stuff like that. We also went out and got we had a a fundraising campaign where we just asked the public, hey, look, you know, if you like this program, send some money. So we raised some money that way. So we're back on the air. The instrument, which had been shut down on tax day in 2011, is observing as we sit here. And we also have all these planets being discovered by NASA's Kepler telescope. Several thousand have been, you know, there's several thousand candidates. Not all of them will turn out to be planets, but probably 90% of them will be. So we're looking at those because at least those are star systems, again, where we know that there are some worlds.
So funding, just to break it up into categories, something like a few possible sources. One is that you partner with other people who you share the array with them, so they just cover costs. Two would be just like Alan, just billionaire.
Somebody just writing
benefactors,
you a check.
Yeah. And then just going to the people, just going to you know, crowdsourcing the money, I guess. What do you think about the idea of shifting more towards just like micro donations from millions of people, that kind of funding, to be with social networking in the internet and whatnot? Is that something you guys are looking into?
I hope that we are. I think we should be because, you know, I think a lot of people, I've often been of the opinion that if your form 1040, if your tax form had a little checkbox at the end, would you like to lower, you know, your refund by $1 by giving $1 to the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence? If 10% of the population did that, well, we'd have, you know, I mean, there'd be plenty of SETI research being done.
Right. Yeah, how many checkboxes would be on that form?
Well, that's the problem. And in fact, but you know, the NASA SETI program, it was a NASA program when I joined the SETI Institute. That was killed in 1993. And by a congressman who was trying to prove to his constituency that he was saving the taxpayers' money. And I remember driving home. My next-door neighbor was washing his car, and he'd read the headlines that NASA said he'd been canceled. And he said, well, Seth, I guess you've lost your job, but at least I'm saving 3 cents per year, which is what it was costing him.
Right.
And so he was saving 3 cents per year. He went out and bought a BMW the next week. So that's you wouldn't, that checkbox wouldn't have to be a dollar if it were a dime, and enough people checked it.
Yeah. All right. Well, definitely keep us updated. I mean, you know, it's SETI is something I believe very, you know, firmly in. I definitely think it's worth the amount of money that we're spending on it. And I think, you know, so
I hope it's worth more than that, Steve.
Well, yeah, no, it should
listen,
be worth a lot more.
Let me just say something in that regard. The whole idea was cooked up more than 50 years ago.
Yeah.
To, you know, point antennas toward the sky. And then we only had guesses about whether the stars had planets or how many planets there were or any of them might have life and that sort of thing. And, you know, we've learned something about some of the questions that were formulated a half century ago. And they've all come up thumbs up in the sense that they're all pointing to the idea that our situation here on Earth is nothing special. We're not special. And it could have gone the other way. There could have been showstoppers. It could have been that planets were rare or, you know, that kind of thing. And none of that has turned out to be the case. Every time you learn something new about the universe, it seems even more attractive for life. So, you know, from that point of view, it's like being on a desert island. You begin to see boot prints from pirates.
Do you think that public interest?
Do you want to meet the pirates, though?
Space pirates.
I don't know. They may have some good grub.
Do you think public interest is increasing because of all the exoplanets that are being discovered?
Well, that's hard to say. Probably it is. I mean, it's very difficult to judge what excites the public about this sort of work. The only real bump in interest from the media that I ever saw was when The X-Files was popular.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, maybe when Neil deGrasse Tyson comes out with the Cosmos series, that'll inspire people to get more involved.
Let's hope.
Good.
When is that coming out?
Isn't it this fall?
2013. About a year from now.
Okay.
About a year.
The audience thinks it's 2014.
2014?
Is it 14?
They sound really sure themselves.
Oh, they pushed it. I heard originally 2013.
Wow, a long time.
I'm not surprised.
All right.
They're doing a good job.
Well, before we go on to science or fiction, we're going to take some questions from our live studio audience.
Hi, my name is Jared Dickman.
Hi, Jared.
So I had this whole spiel worked out about what I want to say to you guys, and let me just start off with hi. You mentioned some guy had been listening since he was 14. That's nothing. I have been listening for 6.5 years since I was around 12 years old.
Oh my God.
Yeah, yeah. Right? And I didn't have a great
family.
I didn't have the best family life growing up, which is, you know, whatever. What I did have every week was you guys, you know, talking to me about what I did want to hear. And I just want to say I love you guys.
You can stay.
Thank you so much for everything that you do. And keep doing it because it is making a difference. That being said...
Wait, you can't even legally drink, can you?
No. Nope. That being said, what I do want to do is I want to change the world. And I want to do that with the tools that you guys have given me of science and critical thinking.
You're going to say that. You got to say it the right way.
I want to change the world.
Now I believe you.
For good or for evil.
We'll work that part out later. All right. Yeah. Important.
I love it.
But what I do, how I want to do it, and no thanks to Bob of all people, I'm currently studying computer engineering and physics. I want to go into quantum computing or, quantum engineering or something like that and just go crazy with that, see what that has to offer.
Awesome.
So my question for you guys is this. The technological singularity, imminent in my humble opinion, is arguably the end game for humanity. You know, that's what we've been working towards. That's what it is. What do you think the most important or maybe most three important scientific fields are to getting us there as quickly as possible?
artificial intelligence. That's key. There's classics, artificial intelligence, there's genetic engineering, and there's
nanotechnology.
Those three are they can all enhance each other.
The Holy Trinity.
If you've got mature nanotechnology, then you could. It just helps with so many other fields. But
I would say.
But AI, the classic definition, I think, of the singularity is AI, because then you've got a human level intelligence, and once you reach that, then you just make it a little faster, and it's superhuman. So then, that's one of the ways. There's lots of ways to define the singularity. Being unable to predict what this thing is going to do is a key aspect of it. So once we have AI, then that's the singularity in my mind.
Yeah, somebody was arguing to me to actually stop studying quantum computing and go into artificial intelligence hardcore, because once we can beat the Turing test, that's it. And then we can just have a computer build a smart computer.
The Turing test is not the be-all and end-all of artificial intelligence.
But,
a lot of reasons.
Human intelligence.
It'd be impressive.
And I was trying to counter-argue that, and I couldn't think of any great reasons as to why we need anything or,
Jared, what I want to know is, why do you want to hurry up the singularity? Why do you want this to happen? You lose control of the planet. Is there some reason you want to lose control of the planet? That's one way to change the world.
Well, he already said he identifies with Bob, who we've already established is a sociopath.
But Seth, that
sociopath.
Your statement implies that we have control now, and I don't really.
From the dog's point of view, we do. I think that we have control. But the singularity is where, in fact, all this rapid improvement in the ability of machines suddenly, it's becoming. It's exponential, and then it reaches a point where it just trumps everything that we do. Now, why is it that you look forward to this?
Well, because what I think is going to happen, and I could be totally wrong, of course, here, but I think that humans and robots are going to merge as the singularity comes closer, and it's not going to be Homo sapiens and robots, it's going to be Homo robotica. And we are going to move forward and expand out from there.
I'd like to think you're right, but what will happen between now and then, of course, is we'll be doing things like putting chips in your brain and all that sort of thing.
Who's going to be working for who? That's what
I'm exactly. And the point is, you can do that, but to me, that's like putting a four-cylinder engine in a horse. You get a faster horse for a while, but eventually you decide, the heck with the horse part, we'll just build the Maserati. Right. So
but
the idea that we're going to be simpatico with the machines, it's like, don't worry, dinos, we may get wiped out, but we're going to merge with the mammals.
the difference, though, you're right. A horse and a car, why merge them? Just build a car. But that's because those are both tools for us. But we're the people that we're trying to merge with the machines. Yeah. I do think that changes the nature of the game a little bit, because when we can be as whatever, are as smart as our artificial intelligence because we have mature brain machine interface, I think that would make us more willing to embrace that technology if it's us and not just tools that we're building. And it also changes, it has the potential to change our potential in terms of what we can do and how long we can live and all these kind of things. I think – I don't know. That's just another wrinkle in all of this, because it's changing humanity.
Right, but don't forget, though.
It's different than just improving our own tools.
But machine intelligence evolves differently than biological cyborg intelligence. And you've got a very small window there. The machine intelligence can evolve so much quicker and more and faster than we could upgrading ourselves. And that's a big difference.
What if we become the machine intelligence? So just imagine.
I think that's key. We might need to make sure that happens.
For all intents and purposes, an AI, but it's designed to be a symbiotic relationship with your own brain so that it is you, but it's interfacing with your brain because you're your brain too. So,
but who makes the contract?
Right.
I want to know who.
What will your brain evolve into with these mechanisms? I mean, it's dicey and it's very risky.
I'm with Bob on this. I mean, you can say you're going to keep up, but we haven't changed much since the time of the ancient Greeks. And the machines are doubling in speed every 18 months. Mm-hmm. There's a completely different rate of improvement there. I think the interesting question is what James is asking, and that is who's in charge of whom, right?
Right.
And if you go to AI conferences, they talk about instilling moral behavior in the machines, which is just code for saying, how can we be sure to be able to pull the plug?
Right.
Right.
How do
and the point is, you can pull the plug for a while. The first generation of thinking machines, you can put all the moral codes in there. You can put in Asimov's rules of robotics. Mm-hmm. You can just tell them, play nice. And maybe the first generation will. But there's no reason to think that the fifth generation, which has been designed by generations 2, 3, and 4, will care anything about that. It isn't to say they're inimical. They may not wipe you out. I mean, I have goldfish at home, but I don't wipe them out.
They'll enslave us.
So, I don't know if they enslave you, but the point is that you've created an intelligence that's almost orthogonal to yours very quickly.
Right.
What does that mean?
It means there's no overlap.
Well, okay, so I look at it like this. First of all, I think it is inevitable, and we need to talk about it, right? It's one of those things that we have to take very seriously and discuss. You know, I don't necessarily disagree with Seth. I've been reading a lot about the singularity lately, and it's becoming a much more scary concept to me now than ever before. I think it is something that absolutely could easily take over humanity and wipe us out. That being said, if it's inevitable, we have to do our magic now to deal with it. We have to talk about it. We have to figure out how we're going to handle it and what we want it to be, shape it. Now, why are you laughing at me? What's going on over here?
It's just Jared's looking forward to it. That's why I was laughing.
Well, I mean, look, we look forward to it. Like, I get where he's coming from, too, because, you know, I'm looking at, like, I think of the singularity like, oh, my God, we're going to have so much information, you know, so much incredible stuff that we could use from, all this research, thousands of years of human research could be
done.
In
a week, right?
And then, you know, like, I have this little fixation on not dying, which would be very lovely
That'd
to
cool.
happen,
mm-hmm.
right? So that would hopefully happen as well and all these good things and all that. But, yeah, I see where you're coming from, too. And I want more people to have your – like, hey guys, you know, don't just put this thing up like it's the, you know, the best thing since sliced bread. Let's freaking talk about it because it's scary and it's dangerous.
Yeah. I'm not sure that's my attitude, but I
think it's either going to be utopian or dystopian, and it's either going to be the greatest thing humanity's ever known or the worst, and let's try and embrace it and make it the best if it's probably inevitable.
Yeah, I agree with that.
There's a science fiction story by Stanislaw Lem. I'm sure I mispronounced his name, but what is it, Golem 14 or Golem 13 or something like that, where the military designs a thinking machine for their own purposes, and the machine does its thing for the military. But then, of course, that machine designs the next generation, which is a little better, still works for the military. But by the third generation, it's not interested in working for the military. You know, I'm not into that gig anymore, right? And very shortly thereafter, it closes itself off from humanity. It's not that it wipes us out. It only wipes you out if you try and cut off the power to the thing. Mm-hmm. Then it'll wipe you out. But otherwise, it has no interest in you. It's like your attitude toward the ants in the backyard. You're not going to wipe them out.
Yeah.
You're a lot smarter than they are, but you're not going to wipe them out. And this machine is doing something. Nobody knows what.
That's scary.
Cool. That's really
scary.
All right, well, so like clarify your position, because you just said you weren't.
I'm all with Jared. Let's develop the thinking machines. I think it'd be interesting. But hey, après moi le déluge.
Wow.
Did he just become the classiest person here?
All right, then. Well, let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts.
But not this week.
Not this week, because Rebecca, you're going to take over.
That's right.
Is your first one?
No,
we've done it before.
Uh-huh. Yeah, this was a terrible decision on my part.
Wasn't it? It's harder than it looks, isn't it?
A lot especially of work. When it's you're annoying. Prepping for
you're
a live
I make it look
show
easy?
and a trip. Yeah. No, the reason why I was really inspired to take this on, though, is because 2 weeks ago in podcasting time, Steve did a science or fiction that he likes to do themes. And usually when he does a theme, he specifically picks a theme that I hate and know nothing about. So that one was, I believe, carbon nanotubes.
Carbon nanotubes.
I could not care less about it. I care. No, I care. I care. I just don't. They do everything. Okay, I get it. They're magic.
You're disinterested in nanotubes?
Right. Yes, I'm completely disinterested. No.
Disinterested.
So I wanted to get back at Steve, basically.
Right.
So today's science or fiction, there is a theme. And the theme
is unicorns.
Close.
Rainbows.
Close. Sloths.
Sloths. Ooh,
I like sloths.
The humble sloth. Okay, so I normally, when we do this online, we have the ability to send each other the items so we can read them. So in this case, since we can't do that, I'm going to read them, and then I'm going to pass around my iPad so you guys can take a look at them.
Okay.
Or other things on there. Yeah.
Don't look through my porn, please. My iPad porn.
iPorn.
Does that happen? Does anybody know?
Maybe. Somehow I think it's all unicorn stuff, isn't it?
It's mostly uniporn.
Uniporn.
Unicorn porn.
It's redundant, but yeah.
Okay. So, oh, and also because Steve did it, there are four items this week.
Oh, gosh.
I'm surprised you didn't go to five.
So there are 12 items.
No.
Each if I had had more time, totally. If the internet hadn't been so spotty. Okay, so here they are. Again, one of these is the fiction. Number one, recent phylogenetic analyses suggest an extremely recent common ancestor between two-toed sloths and three-toed sloths, which occupy the same territory, subsist on the same diet, and even have the same number of toes, despite the name difference. Number two, sloths move so slowly that a blue-green algae grows on them, living symbiotically within its hollow hairs and providing sustenance for dozens of varieties of arthropods. Number three, despite the fact that they are incapable of walking, sloths climb down from the trees, poop in a small hole at the foot of the tree, and then climb back up. And number four, sloths are graceful swimmers who can perform a breaststroke and are descended from an aquatic sloth ancestor. Those are your items. Bob.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
We love
you. Just look
Bob.
So pleased right now.
I
like
should have
just,
sat over there.
You
no,
just
I'm
can't
good.
Believe your luck.
Pull the audience, Bob.
Are we going to pull the audience?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
All right.
Good.
Well, wait, let me see them again. So I remember
give
which one's
quick
which.
Jot, yeah.
Okay. Who thinks the first item is fictional about two-toed sloths and three-toed sloths having a recent common ancestor? Oh, all right.
Whoa. That's
that
a first.
Stone cold.
Yeah. Number two, the blue-green algae growing on sloths. Who thinks that's fiction? I think they're just scared. Okay, number three, that sloths are incapable of walking but still climb down the tree to poop in a hole.
Wow. That was the only one I thought was...
All right. And number four, that sloths are graceful swimmers. Okay. So it sounds like number three and then number four are the audience favorites.
For fiction.
For fiction.
The first one, the phylogenetic analyses. Yeah, I kind of see that. I never problem with that one. The blue-green algae on for number two. Yeah, I mean, how slow do you have to move for the algae to grow on you? I mean, I think I've got some over now. But yeah, that I'd never problem with that. They move slowly, but that wasn't bothering me either. The third one, their hands are kind of freaky. They're really curved. I could really see them having trouble walking.
Like Sylvia Brown.
Yeah.
That boy's dead.
Please do not besmirch the good name of sloths by comparing them to Sylvia Brown.
Good point. I apologize.
I've never seen them actually walking. How could I not know that? The swimmer one, though, is just kind of freaking me out. How could sloths and graceful swimming just don't go together for me? So I'm just going to – what the hell? I'll pick that one. Who's next?
All right. Let's just head over to Steve.
Yeah, I had the same reaction as Bob when I heard the swimming one. I'm like, wow, that sounds so crazy fiction. That would be
too
incredible.
Obvious, right?
You know, it's almost too obvious. Like, was that the one that inspired the whole theme?
Maybe that's what she wants you to believe.
Excuse me, my great love of sloths inspired the theme.
And an aquatic sloth ancestor. The whole thing just sounded so crazy. The other ones all sound fine. I was trying to remember. Yeah, there's something about the phylogenetic relationship between two-toed and three-toed sloths that's counterintuitive, but I can't remember what it is. So that might
you're
be,
just saying that.
No, there is. There's something I can't remember. It's one of those things. Like, yeah, there's something about that that is just not what you would think it is. Like, they're not as closely related as the names might imply, both being sloths. But I don't know. I don't remember enough about the other. The blue-green algae, fine, sure. The walking, yeah. I mean, you know, sloths climb along the trees and the branches. I don't know if they go down to poop, but they could certainly do that. I think I have to go with the swimming one too. I mean, if that's true, that's amazing. But that one just struck me as so obvious. Fix. I'm just going to go with that because that was my first reaction.
GWB.
All right, GWB. Evan?
Incidentally.
Yeah, I'll just get right to it. I was thinking the swimming one first, the poop one second. But the audience thinks the poop one is a few more people about that one. We're thinking that was fiction.
We've been doing a lot of poop this evening. So.
Yeah, right? Yeah, it's been a very earthy podcast.
Is that a new medicine you're on? Or?
They're incapable of walking. Lots of graceful swimmers. Swimmers. I'll go with the gang. What the heck? All swimmers.
Right. All right.
Fiction.
Jay?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I thought of about the swimming is, like, if you have hooks for hands, like, how the hell can you swim? Like, their hands are just, like Bob was saying.
Catch a lot of fish on the
way. Like, remember those monkey toys we used to have when we were kids?
Yes. You hang
the
them all together.
Hands, you slide them down.
They didn't swim very well.
No, but I can't imagine sloth. Like, it's like they can't move, but they get in the water and they're, like, doing Olympic swimming. Like, they can barely move. I saw a sloth crawl across the street. It took them, like, 15 minutes to crawl. And there's people, like, blocking them. And then you get them in the pool and they take off like rockets.
I was thinking,
and,
if only I was swimming.
I can't imagine that being true. And this is going to be, like, such an amazing win for you, Rebecca, because I have to say the swimming thing.
All right. What do you think, Seth?
I have to say I don't know anything about sloths except for the guys who are supposedly responsible for maintenance in our high school. So I'm not sure. The only one that I can, I mean, to say and are descended from an aquatic sloth ancestor. Aren't we all descended from aquatic ancestors? So I found it a little bit bizarre that they would climb down from the trees and poop into a hole because I can't think of any evolutionary benefit for them doing that. And it sounds like an awful lot of work. So, I'd say that's the one.
If you're in a tree, just why not just crap from the branch, right, and let it drop?
Well, I'm going to poop on the poop one. I can't see them climbing out of trees and digging holes. That's a little too civilized for me, so I'm going to turn that one down. I think that's a loser.
You're going with
the poop. Okay, there we go.
Yep.
All right. Should we poll the audience
again
and see?
Let's poll the audience.
All right. So let's see if they swayed you guys at all. Who thinks that the fiction is the two-toed sloths and the three-toed sloths having an extremely recent common ancestor? Still no one.
Crickets.
Who thinks that the fiction is sloths getting a blue-green algae? All right. Poop.
Wait, we just had people clap for poop. That was the whole point of the past 2 hours.
The only reason I And sloths as graceful swimmers. It's still pretty even between the two. All right, I'm going to take them in seemingly random order. Let's start with the algae. Everybody seemed to buy into that pretty quickly. Sloths move so slowly that a blue-green algae grows on them, living symbiotically within its hollow hairs and providing sustenance for dozens of varieties of arthropods. That is, in fact, science. Yay. So well done. It's kind of cool. They do, in fact, move that slowly, and the algae helps protect them because one of sloths' biggest predators are raptors, not Velosa, but you know, flying.
When
the sloth is covered in the algae and just sort of
camouflage,
hanging there,
camouflage?
They look exactly like a big clump of leaves. And they have this incredible, like almost ecosystem of bugs all over them. It's really pretty.
That's what happens when you move.
Yeah, sounds yummy.
Which is another good reason why they wouldn't swim. All right.
Oh,
just throwing that out there.
All right, let's go to the other one that everybody thought was science, which is recent phylogenetic analyses suggest an extremely recent common ancestor between two-toed sloths and three three-toed sloths, which occupy the same territory, subsist on the same diet, and even have the same number of toes despite the name difference. That one is, in fact, fiction! You all
no
lose!
No way!
You all lose! Yeah, I thought Steve was going to get it.
Yeah, I was.
I really thought you were going
to
do it.
I knew if I remembered what I was supposed to remember about that, I probably would have gotten
the one. Science part of that is that two- and three-toed sloths do, in fact, share the same territory. They have the same diet. The only real difference between them is size difference, but that's the really fascinating thing about them. They are so similar, but their common ancestor is incredibly distant. They've just
convergent evolution.
It's a beautiful example of convergent evolution.
I hate convergent evolution
because they damn you convergent evolution.
Damn you, God.
Yeah, because they occupied that same area. They were under the same pressures and they evolved in pretty much exactly the same way. Hmm. And actually, let me pull this note up.
You're really passionate about these guys.
I love sloths.
So do they have hooks for hands?
Like Captain Hook. That's what you're picturing.
I mean,
claws. And that's
you
the other thing
branches,
is that
kind of
despite the name, all sloths have three toes. Yeah. But their claws, which are technically on their sloth hands, two-toed have two claws and three-toed.
Have you ever held one?
No. I would die. I would melt.
Yeah, from all that algae and stuff.
Yeah, the bugs and whatever else.
Here's a cool thing about sloth evolution. I found this quote from a researcher. Even the animals they're most closely related to, anteaters and armadillos, are as different from sloths as whales are from bats.
Wow, sweet.
That's
awesome?
A big difference.
Yeah. Different. I thought that was really cool.
Genetically?
So let's go and do the other two, even though you all lost and it's pretty much, it's done now. the poop thing. So despite the fact that they are incapable of walking, sloths climb down from the trees, poop in a small hole at the foot of the tree, and then they climb back up.
But they're so slow, they have science. To actually think, I'm going to need to poop in about 4 hours.
Well, here's what that I almost put this as the item, which is sloths, this is true, sloths poop once a week.
Wow.
That's awesome.
Sloths have such incredibly slow metabolism.
They need a hell of a poop.
Stand back.
Actually, you are
small
absolutely
hole.
Correct. I read a paper that said that 30% of their body weight in one evacuation was not unheard
of. Jay, you've done that.
Okay. Again, why do you guys know so much about Jay and his poop?
He posted on Facebook. And
sloths do not poop in the trees, and there are a number of guesses for why they do this. There's no solid evidence, but some of the guesses.
I got it. Yeah.
Thank you.
No crap where you eat.
But they're in a tree. Just let it drop.
But they're upside down.
Okay.
Feces dropping from the tree are a signal to predators, like the birds that are hunting them.
Oh, they get out of the way.
But they got the algae to protect them. They're cool.
But exactly, though. The algae does, but until the sound happens. And then the birds are very good at swooping in. And there's video, if you can stomach it. There's actually video of a bird swooping in and like flipping upside down and grabbing a sloth right off of a tree branch. And
aren't they
carrying
big, though?
Away.
I mean, aren't
they're, you know, they can be like, they're, I figure like a cat size, large
really?
Cat sometimes. Well, two-toed are small, three-toed are a little bigger, but there are some large birds that can easily snatch them.
And you're really fascinated with these, aren't you, Rebecca?
A little bit, a little bit. So wait, there's another possible reason for not pooping from the tree and actually going down and burying it. And this is a bit more difficult to believe, but it is interesting. The poop fertilizes the tree, burying it right under the tree, fertilizes it and produces better food for the sloth to go eat.
Ooh, so they're nice. Farmers.
they're basically farmers.
Hey, tell me about extinct giant sloths. Weren't they like huge at one point? Like really,
they were.
Like
we talked about it. I did a This Day in History a few weeks ago about Jefferson discovering what he thought was a lion, or he didn't discover it, but he delivered a paper on it. Mm-hmm. He thought it was a lion and asked Lewis and Clark to find it on their expedition. They didn't, because it was an extinct giant sloth.
Cool.
And that was another potential item, was that, Bigfoot in the U.S., in South America, there's a common myth of a living giant sloth, only it's not just a giant sloth. It's terrifying. It's you know, it's still very slow.
If you stand still for eight hours, you're in deep shit.
But, zombies, very slow, very scary. It can happen.
That's what movie was that from? There's a steamroller coming at a guy, and it's moving like a half mile, and he's like, ah!
It's like a fish called Wanda.
No, yeah, Austin, right. Austin Powers.
But he was cemented in. That's why.
Oh, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Never mind.
Yeah, that's scary. Austin Powers.
So holy shit! I just realized something. They can swim crazy.
They can swim.
Oh, come on. I want to see a YouTube video.
There are tons of YouTube videos on it, and they are amazing.
There's a sloth channel on YouTube.
Yeah, and one of the – so they do have an ancestor that was probably a mostly aquatic sloth. There's really good evidence to suggest. They found these fossils, and they looked particularly at the teeth, and they found that in – older versions of the sloth. This is technical language. It's very late. aquatic sloth 1.0 had teeth that were really nicked up. And what they figure happened was that it was foraging. It lived in a desert area, but that ran into some water. And the only plants around were by the water. So the wear on the teeth, they think, came from sand that they scooped up as they were grabbing plants on the edge of the water. But later versions of the sloth, they found that the sand was beginning to disappear. And the only explanation they can come up with is that the sloth was moving further and further and further into the water until it was completely in the water and just foraging on aquatic plant life. So they do have that ancestor. And right now, there are sloths that live in areas that can be flooded. And when that happens, they literally can just drop out of the tree and immediately start swimming, and they do this breaststroke. I found one thing that I could not verify was that depending on which way they land, they will do either a breaststroke or a backstroke.
Awesome.
But I was because the internet connection was so low, I couldn't find a video of the backstroke, so I didn't include that. But I thought that was pretty cool. They are very good swimmers, and you can find it on YouTube.
Awesome. Good job, Rebecca. Yeah.
Thank you.
Good job. Nice.
Bitch. And Rebecca, you stumped more people at one time than anybody else ever.
Awesome.
That's pretty cool.
This has been Sloth Facts with Rebecca. there was actually one other thing that I wanted to mention that I thought was really interesting, but I tried. I could not verify this, but in Salmon of Doubt, Douglas Adams' book. Douglas Adams says that his favorite fact is that young sloths are so inept at climbing that they often mistake their own arms and legs for tree limbs and they fall.
Oh my God.
And the best I could confirm was that there is evidence to suggest that climbing amongst sloths is a learned behavior. And so that could suggest that maybe baby sloths are morons. climbing. So, but yeah, I couldn't find any. No video evidence of baby sloths like falling down
tree.
So, yeah.
Okay. Good job, Rebecca.
Thank you.
Jay, do you have a quote to end our live show with?
I have a quote from the incredible Carl Sagan. This was actually from his Cosmos TV show, and the quote is: "The suppression of uncomfortable ideas may be common in religion or in politics, but is not the path to knowledge. And there's no place for it in the endeavor of science. We do not know beforehand where fundamental insights will arise from about our mysterious and lovely solar system. The history of our study of our solar system shows us clearly that accepted and conventional ideas are often wrong, and that fundamental insights can arise from the most unexpected sources." Carl Sagan!
Thank you. Thank you, Jay.
Thank you for joining us, everyone. Randy, thanks again for joining us. Seth, always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you guys for joining me this week. And thanks to our live audience.
Great week, guys. Thank you.
Good night.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.